The Trump White House is ratcheting up pressure on Venezuela. The government there is rounding up dissenters.
We don't know the conditions. We don't know if they're being tortured, if they're being subjected to cruel treatment.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, the rapid expansion of a new megacity in southern China.
At the very beginning, it's a very small village, actually. There's not a lot of people living here.
And what's next for Ukraine peace talks as Putin meets the U.S. envoy?
I don't think the American people are going to want to just go along and do business with Putin and throw the Ukrainians under the bus.
Plus, mold at the Chernobyl nuclear site.
Toxic? I wouldn't necessarily eat it. Like, you wouldn't eat your moldy bread either.
But it can also block nuclear radiation. All those stories and more today on The World. We begin today in Venezuela, where the Trump administration is stepping up its pressure campaign against the government in Caracas. On Saturday, President Trump said that Venezuela's airspace is now, quote, closed in its entirety. This is after weeks of a massive U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean. Experts say the Trump administration is looking to force regime change in Venezuela. But while attention is focused on U.S. actions, the political repression inside Venezuela is reaching new levels as President Nicolas Maduro cracks down on dissent. The World's TV Saya starts us off today.
A few weeks ago, a 65-year-old cardiologist in western Venezuela was sentenced to 30 years in prison, the maximum penalty. Her crime? Sending a WhatsApp voice note. Dr. Margie Orozco shared a message in a neighborhood WhatsApp group. Her son, Paul Ruiz, says it was a call to vote against President Nicolás Maduro in last year's presidential election.
Entonces, bueno, mi mamá dice eso, que el país está muy mal, que no hay comida, que la gente se está muriendo de hambre.
He says his mother was describing what many Venezuelans experience on a daily basis. Food and medicine shortages, miserable salaries, and rampant corruption.
O sea, está diciendo la verdad. Pero claro, pero a ellos no les gusta eso.
She was telling the truth, he says, but the government doesn't like that. Her message was flagged by a local pro-government activist who reported it to authorities, he says. And a few days later, military officers showed up at Dr. Orozco's home without an arrest warrant. She never came back. Her son says the trial was a sham.
No hizo nada ilegal. Ella lo único que hizo fue, su único delito fue haberme enviado un mensaje de WhatsApp. Más nada. Listo.
She did nothing illegal, he says. Her only crime was sending a WhatsApp voice message. Ruiz says his mother, who is a senior citizen, spent days in custody without access to a lawyer, and the conditions were severe.
Ella tenía que dormir ahí en el piso. Ahí no habían camas, no había baño.
She was sleeping on the floor. There were no bathrooms, just a hole in the ground. Dr. Orozco is not the only one caught in this new wave of repression. Last year, community organizer Zuleika Meneses was also targeted. She helped the opposition collect and protect voting tallies from the presidential election. Evidence, she says, that showed Maduro lost.
Tuvimos una victoria contundente. Recogimos todas las actas.
That's
no
why the government started going after people who monitor the vote, she says.
Nos marcó la persecución más fuerte. Abandonamos la casa y lamentablemente no pudimos regresar.
She was able to leave the country with her parents a few days after the elections and is now in the U.S. requesting asylum. But her aunt and cousin were still there when officers came looking for her.
Luego de eso, mi casa fue allanada. Se llevaron detenida a mi tía, se llevaron detenida a mi prima.
They were detained and her cousin is still in custody. Human rights groups say this tactic of arresting relatives when authorities can't find the person they want is becoming more common in Venezuela.
Everyone that's been detained is referred to as terrorist or is being charged as terrorist.
Alfredo Romero is the head of the NGO Foro Penal. He says the detainees are facing tough charges and access to them is tightly restricted.
Something that is very worrying is that we don't know the conditions of them. We don't know if they're being tortured, if they're being subjected to cruel treatment, for example.
a United Nations independent fact-finding mission has documented arbitrary arrests, torture, sexual violence, and forced disappearances in Venezuela. Romero's group says there are more than 800 political prisoners in Venezuela right now. Genesis Davila, a Venezuelan human rights attorney, says there is no rule of law. She says prosecutors, judges, and public defenders are expected to follow political instructions from the regime.
If they don't, they face retaliation.
She says political prisoners can no longer choose their own lawyers. And in the past, lawyers who took their cases became targets. So do academics and economists who publish information the government doesn't like. Human rights groups say October saw the highest level of repression in months, with dozens detained, many linked to opposition leader Maria Corina Machado. Davila says prison conditions are inhumane.
Some go days or even weeks without seeing sunlight.
Others are given food with worms or denied visits from their families, she says. People in Venezuela are afraid of speaking publicly against the regime. Andreina Baduel is one of the few who does. Her father, former defense minister Raúl Baduel, died in custody after years of torture, according to his family. She says Venezuelans have tried every democratic avenue to demand change. They have protested, voted in rigged elections, negotiated, and denounced human rights abuses. Baduel says for many families, the only hope left is help from abroad. Many Venezuelans support the U.S. military buildup, even though experts say any unilateral intervention would be illegal. But these Venezuelans argue the world is focusing too much on the legality of U.S. actions and ignoring daily abuses happening inside Venezuela.
Es un llamado de auxilio a lograr una transición que nos ayude a los venezolanos a construir el país que queremos.
Zulaika Meneses, the activist, says Venezuelans are crying for help to build the country they want. More than 30% of the population fled during Maduro's rule. And for many of those who remain there, removing Maduro from power feels existential. For the world, I'm Tibisay Sea, Mexico City.
In Hong Kong, officials say more than 150 people are confirmed dead in a massive fire that destroyed high-rise apartment buildings last week. Many people are still missing. Police have searched 5 of the 7 towers that were engulfed in flames. So far, authorities have made more than a dozen arrests in connection to the disaster. Tom Grundy is the editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press. He spoke with us earlier today.
Very heavy atmosphere still here in Hong Kong. This is a huge estate of 8 towers. There are 2,000 units across 31 floors. You know, Hong Kong has among the highest population densities in the world, people living on top of each other in these beehive-like towers. And it was home to 4,000 residents that are now displaced and are staying in temporary accommodation. 7 of these 8 towers at this complex were affected, and the police have now searched 5 of them. They found 8 bodies today. And a tearful police officer talking about a scene of complete devastation. The last 2 towers that they're looking at now might take 3 weeks to search, if only because it's so dark and the situation now is so grim. Regret to report that some of the residents literally reduced to ashes, and so maybe hard to identify, but there are still people holding out hope, and we have about 30 still unaccounted for.
I mean, grim really is the word. There was speculation last week that bamboo scaffolding was the cause of the fire. What are officials saying about that now?
Yeah, so I think Hong Kong moved on from that quite quickly. It is not really being pointed to as a cause of the spread of this fire. There have been different analyses and investigations over recent days. They have settled on the styrofoam that was flammable and put onto windows, which is not within fire safety requirements. And just in the last few hours, we've heard that the netting a lot of that that is used on the outside of the scaffolding was not fire retardant. In fact, what happened was that on the lower floors, that netting seemed to be okay. But in recent weeks, there's been a few fires at different construction sites, and it has been alleged by the authorities that the renovation firm went out, having been very concerned about recent fires across the territory, purchased some netting that was fire compliant, but only put it on the bottom of these towers so that it would pass the relevant assessments.
I'm curious, why was there this scaffolding in the first place? Was there repairs or was there construction going on?
Yeah, this was a years-long renovation by Prestige Construction and Engineering Limited. And 30 of the projects linked to this construction firm have been suspended across the city since then. We're only in the early days of understanding what's happened at these towers, but it seems also that there were elements of corruption regarding the construction firm too. There have been multiple arrests, in fact. 13 people now arrested for suspected manslaughter. Many of them were at the construction contractor, the construction consultancy firm, or subcontractors in charge of the scaffolding or the exteriors. And the anti-corruption watchdog has made 12 arrests. So 12 of these 13 people have been arrested twice, once by the anti-corruption watchdog and by the police.
And what are police saying about the suspects in these arrests and the investigation of the cause of the fire so far? Anything?
No, that's all we have at the moment. I'm not sure we've even seen them in court as yet, but we've also had some arrests, of course, for sedition.
Sedition, explain.
So quite separately to the cause of the fire, there was a student who was arrested for alleged sedition on Saturday in relation to the blaze, in the sense that he was handing out leaflets calling for the government to be held to account, for them to launch an independent investigation. But the government do have some jitters about finger pointing at the authorities here, as you often see in mainland China. Beijing itself has actually threatened so-called anti-China disruptors, as they say, using the fire to incite resentment against the government. So in all this, we know of two arrests for inciting hatred against the government, and the students as well, who may have been arrested for a similar offense.
Right. If that was the case for the student, it does seem like an especially vocal expression of anger. What has been the general public reaction in Hong Kong to this whole fire?
Well, you go down there and there certainly is, there's grief, there is anger, and there are questions about the government in the sense that they are supposed to enact and regulate these things. And there was an inspection of this very complex just a week before the fire. Now, this is the first time any kind of tragedy has happened like this in Hong Kong since the 2020 security law was enacted, and another local security law in the last year or two. And so it's a bit of a test, because it already seems that within days, the patience for people pointing the finger at the authorities does seem to be wearing quite thin already with the authorities in Hong Kong.
So what are the next steps here in the investigation, Tom? Just briefly, can the Hong Kong and Beijing government simply conclude the investigation and leave it at that with little or no accountability?
Well, the arrests happened quite quickly, certainly more quickly than in the UK when there was a similar incident at the Grenfell Towers. Mm. But then it's more in the long term as to whether there will be more systematic, fundamental change, a crackdown on these building committees or firms, or indeed anything in terms of taking responsibility from the authorities themselves. Bear in mind also, the government, just in the last day or two, has decided that it is going to proceed with its patriots-only election, where the candidates are pre-selected. That's going to take place on Sunday, and they've been very nervous about ensuring a good turnout, probably to ensure that it looks as credible as possible. But the government is pressing forward with that. But like I say, it's a very restricted election. So who knows what appetite these incoming patriotic lawmakers will have for really digging down into some of the root causes of what may have laid the ground for this kind of incident to happen.
Tom Grundy is the editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press. He spoke with us this evening local time from Hong Kong. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. The Trump administration has engaged in a new round of negotiations aimed at ending the war in Ukraine, but progress toward peace? Elusive is the word. Tomorrow, Russian leader Vladimir Putin is set to meet with U.S. envoy Steve Witkoff. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky met today with French President Emmanuel Macron, seeking support from European allies. Meanwhile, the White House is reportedly pressing Ukraine to hand over its eastern Donbas region to Russia, including areas Moscow has not captured on the battlefield. Zelensky has called that demand a non-starter, warning that such a concession could be politically explosive at home. Michael McFaul served as U.S. ambassador to Russia during the Obama administration. He directs the Freeman Spoley Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Ambassador, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me.
What's at the top of the agenda when Putin and Witkoff sit down tomorrow to talk about Ukraine?
The two biggest issues are, one, Putin wants Donbas. He's wanted that since 2014, and his soldiers have not captured that. That's an eastern part of Ukraine. And the Ukrainians want a security guarantee. They want to know that the West, and the United States in particular, will help them prevent a future war. How you get that trade space together, I think, is the fundamental issues left in terms of trying to end this war. But they're fundamental and hard, and I'm not optimistic we'll achieve that outcome from this visit from Mr. Witkoff this week.
So the Kremlin wants the entire Donbas region. Do you think they'll get it if Kyiv got security guarantees? I mean, is that even up for debate?
Marco, I can't think of another war termination scenario where one side had to give up territory they held. So Putin's demand here is very maximalist. What we don't know is it maximalist now, but could be softened if there could be a deal? I've negotiated with the Russians before, and I can tell you that they always hold out maximalist positions to the very end. Mm. That, I think, is what Mr. Witkoff needs to test this week.
So let's put a pin in this fundamental territory question and just want to ask about something else. A story in the Wall Street Journal shows how efforts to broker peace between Russia and Ukraine are bound up with business deals, including access to multi-billion dollar rare earth minerals and energy resources. What is Russia proposing there?
From the very first meeting that Secretary Rubio had with Foreign Minister Lavrov, they brought with them a man named Kirill Dmitriev, who is in charge of the Russian Direct Investment Fund. I know him. I used to deal with him. I used to deal with Lavrov as well. That signaled to me that they were going to do what many other countries have done, which is to put money on the table as a way to attract the Trump administration to their position. This reporting in the Wall Street Journal was just extraordinary in its level of detail, going through the things that Dmitriev has put on the table to say, if you give us these concessions, if you give us what we want on the war in Ukraine, we will provide all of these economic opportunities for the United States and for people closely tied to the Trump administration.
I mean, I'd love your thoughts on this because, I mean, so much bloodshed on the battlefield. If economic incentives can lead to peace in Ukraine, is it necessarily a bad thing to be integrating business and diplomacy?
I think lifting sanctions and trade space with regards to ending the war is fine. But the idea that Americans would make money off of the war in Ukraine as an incentive to get us to pressure the Ukrainians, I just don't like the feel of that. This war is not just about money for Americans. And by the way, I don't think just Americans just care about money. I think that's a big misreading that President Trump and his team have. If you look at opinion polls, the majority of Americans still support Ukraine. 80% of the American people do not think that Putin is a good guy. I don't think the American people are going to want to just go along and do business with Putin and throw the Ukrainians under the bus.
So Kyiv, back to the territory, has been pretty clear that concessions on territory are non-starter. As you said earlier, Moscow starts negotiations with maximalist turns, and then they often dial down those demands. Where do you see any room or any scenario by which there could be maneuvering on territorial concessions?
I think the trade space is a real credible security guarantee to Ukraine. And in return, I could then see Zelensky going along with some concessions on territory. He will never, ever de jure recognize part of Ukraine as being part of the Russian Federation, but he could agree to only pursue reunification through peaceful means in return for a security guarantee that makes it certain that Putin won't invade Ukraine again. I think that's where the trade space is.
But to be clear, as a former diplomat, you said earlier, you do not like the idea of money for minerals in exchange for peace.
Well, I just don't think they're related. Why are we trying to take advantage of being the mediators in a way that doesn't help the Ukrainians? Now, I am encouraged by the fact that Secretary Rubio now keeps referring to Ukrainian prosperity as a necessary part of the peace deal. That is encouraging to me. But American prosperity, that should be a different question for a different day.
So the 28-point peace plan we learned about last week strongly favored Russia. Ukraine and its European allies were dead set against it. Is what'll be discussed tomorrow going to be a significant revision of that proposal?
The proposal has been revised through very, I think, productive conversations between the United States and Ukraine after that disastrous Russian plan was floated. My understanding is that what they talked about in Miami was a significant amendment to that. What I don't know is whether Special Envoy Witkoff will actually present that plan to Putin. What we've seen so far is that when Witkoff goes to Russia, he just kind of takes notes and puts down the wish list for Putin and then comes back to Washington saying, this is what they need. That's not negotiation. That's just, you know, acquiescence.
So if the White House truly wanted to demonstrate real pressure on President Putin to negotiate, what would be the most effective way to do that?
Oh, clear as day. More and effective weapons to Ukraine and more and effective sanctions against Russia. You have to put pressure on the Russians. You just can't keep accommodating them if you think there's going to be permissive conditions for ending this war. Wars tend to end in two ways, either a stalemate on the battlefield or one side wins. Right now, in order to create a stalemate on the battlefield, Ukrainian soldiers need more missiles, they need more air defense systems, and we could provide that if we wanted to. So far, President Trump has refused to do so.
We should also remember the very high-profile figure in Ukraine, Andrei Yermak. He was Zelensky's chief of staff. Up until this weekend, he resigned in a corruption scandal. What does that sequence of events mean for Zelensky's ability to persuade allies to support Ukraine?
Well, it's an obvious blow to President Zelensky and his government. It underscores an argument made by some here in the United States that the Ukrainian government's all corrupt. I think now the same people pushing for anti-corruption investigations are some of the most militant people in Ukraine against providing territory to the Russians. So in a way, I think it makes it harder for him to negotiate, not easier for him to negotiate.
Yeah, and if that corruption tag sticks, could you see that as further fodder for American lawmakers to pressure Trump to continue to not give weapons to Ukraine?
Yes. I don't think they need pressure from lawmakers. I think there's a group within the Trump administration that already has that impression. And allegations of corruption, I want to emphasize, we don't know the full details yet with Mr. Yermak and others, but allegations of corruption only reinforces their position that they shouldn't give any money to Ukraine because it's all money wasted.
That's Michael McFaul, a former U.S. ambassador to Russia. He was speaking with us today about the negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Monsoon rains across Southeast Asia have brought devastating floods, killing hundreds of people in recent days. Millions more are displaced. Sri Lanka has been hit especially hard. Here's President Anura Kumara Dissanayake speaking through an interpreter.
As a country, we are facing the largest and most challenging natural disaster in our history.
He said the rescue operation underway is the largest ever in Sri Lanka. Other nations in Southeast Asia are also reeling from the floods. In Thailand, one of the worst hit places is the southern city of Hat Yai. From Bangkok, Patrick Nguyen spoke with people who survived that disaster.
At times, the rain has turned Hat Yai's streets into soupy brown canals, swelling so high that cars and stop signs vanished beneath the surface. The floodwater here is the color of fish sauce and filled with trash. So says Tamonwan Kittub. She goes by the nickname Fa. Fa spent much of the past week gazing at that water in fear. For 6 days, she was trapped on the second floor of a hotel surrounded by flooding, with no electricity, locked in a room alone. If I opened my window at night, she says, I'd see pure darkness and hear nothing but wind and rain. Fa works in Hat Yai, a coastal city. The name means big beach, and the locals are used to some flooding, but not like this. Officials call this a once every 300 years type of flood.
It's rather unprecedented, I would say.
Climate scientist Fredolin Tanggang is a professor emeritus from the University of Malaysia. He's saddened by monsoon deaths across Southeast Asia, but he's not shocked. He says this follows the United Nations climate change projections. When carbon emissions cause the Earth to warm up, oceans soak up much of that heat. That warmth, Professor Tanggang says, can supercharge storms. He says that this will keep happening for years to come.
This is not the end of it, I believe. It's getting worse and worse.
Everyday people don't pore over UN climate reports. So in Thailand, the intensity of these rains took many by surprise. Filmmaker Ekapong Saranset lives a bit south of Hat Yai. He was driving a pickup truck last week on the first day of the floods, and he couldn't believe how quickly the water climbed up to the door of his truck.
It's like I'm riding in a raging ocean. I feel like I was in the sea.
Thailand has a flood warning system. Green means all is well. Yellow means hunker down. Red means get off the street. Try to flee to higher ground. The problem is the warning went suddenly from green almost straight to red. Ekapong was one of millions affected. His truck barely made it home. He rushed upstairs and watched as water poured into the ground floor of his house. He later learned that he was lucky to be away from downtown Hat Yai, a city descending into chaos.
In Hat Yai, it's like a disaster. Yeah, it's like The Purge, you know.
Like The Purge. That's an American horror movie in which society breaks down into anarchy. As for Fa in downtown Hat Yai, she too was caught off guard. On November 21st, she left Hat Yai Hospital, where she works as a pharmacist. Water had started pooling at her feet, so she booked a hotel room to wait out the storm. It'll be just one night, she thought. She would not return home for nearly a week. City streets became fast-moving rivers, as seen in social media footage posted by other flood victims trapped downtown. By day, Fa would see, out her window, cars lifted by the current, smashing into other cars. She'd see pigs floating by, alive and squealing. Fa had a heap of fried rice with her, but she couldn't keep it cold in her warm and balmy room. At night, in the rare hours when rains let up, downtown Hat Yai would echo with shouts and screams. In other videos posted to Facebook, people trapped on roofs and high floors cry out for help. A man says, there's a 9-month-old kid here. Similar pleas rang out from Fa's hotel. Once a military helicopter hovered overhead, and people stuck on the same floor as her screamed at it. She said people shouted, we're hungry. We haven't eaten in 4 days. We've got old people here and little kids. The roar of the chopper's blades drowned out their pleas, and it flew away. On the fourth night, men wearing orange life jackets showed up. With ropes, they rappelled up the side of the hotel. Fa thought, okay, finally help has arrived. But she says the men started looting everything. She realized they're not here to help. These bandits scoured the place for booze. They smashed up an ATM. They found a loose pig and slaughtered it at the hotel. Then they started trying to break into people's rooms. Fa says the scariest part of the whole ordeal was seeing a man clamoring around her window. She says, I had to keep totally still, or else I might not survive. On the sixth day, Fa was ill from eating rotten rice and running a fever. She thought the water might have receded enough to wade through the street. So she sloshed through a city in ruins, finally turning up to the home of a relative. She was soaking wet, sick, and starving. The government was supposed to warn people like Pha well in advance of this vicious storm. It failed. Thailand's Prime Minister, Anutin Chanwitlakun, has apologized. Today, at an outdoor press scrum, the Prime Minister said, "Everyone evacuated will be back home in 7 days, and within 2 weeks, the city of Hat Yai will be cleaned up." That's if the skies remain dry. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
When you think about today's global superpowers, there are likely just two nations on your list, the United States and the People's Republic of China. 50 years ago, though, the idea that China would be a major global rival to the U.S. was tough to imagine. The country was overwhelmingly poor in the 1970s. Most of the population lived in rural areas. China was also technologically backward. Now it's at the cutting edge of high tech. It's got the world's second largest economy and more megacities than any other nation. Today we kick off a week-long series with the world's Jeremy Siegel. He spent time reporting in China recently and has this story about one of those megacities that has become synonymous with the country's extraordinary growth.
The moment I step foot in Shenzhen, I can feel the electricity. The sidewalk is a free-for-all. Crowds of pedestrians, yes, but also thousands of chargeable electric scooters beeping and swerving all around. Standing still amid the chaos isn't easy, but when I do, I see a split-screen image of the city. In one direction, a hodgepodge of crammed high-rise apartment buildings bumping up against one another, laundry strung along windows with just a paper-thin slice of space between buildings in the alleyway. At the entrance to the alley, a street musician sits on a small wooden stool playing the pipa, a Chinese lute. In the other direction, countless pristine, hyper-modern skyscrapers, all lit up red in a coordinated LED light show. Above me, there's the hum of drones carrying packages and food for deliveries to one of the city's roughly 20 million residents.
Around this row, you see very tall building, very modern, right? Behind the tall, modern building, you see all of these small, you know, we call them village inside the city, right?
It's all unbelievable, Jinfen Zhang says, not just because it feels like the city is bursting at its seams with people, buildings, robots, and lights, but also because half a century ago, virtually nothing was here.
At the very beginning, it's a very small village, actually. There's not a lot of people living here.
Zhang is a professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong in Shenzhen. I meet up with him in his office on the 14th floor of one of those impressive skyscrapers and can't believe what I see below.
This is it's an incredible building. What, you have great views up here.
This is the main road in Shenzhen.
Yeah.
The main road. Mm-hmm. Right, so this city is just 1/7 of the size of Beijing, but hosts almost the same population as Beijing. So it's very crowded, actually.
Like most of the city's residents, Zhang moved here for work and isn't originally from Shenzhen. But you can see the excitement and pride on his face as he describes the city to me. China is famous for its hukou system, a rigid household registration program that's historically tied citizens to their place of birth and prevented people from moving around. But Shenzhen, Zhang tells me, is different. The rules are more lax. It's a city of migrants, somewhere where young people move to find opportunity.
I think it really is an amazing place. It's very energetic. You seldom see senior people, right? All people are young, very, very, you know, energetic. That's really impressive.
Particularly impressive because just decades ago, you wouldn't have been able to find Shenzhen on a map. Under the rule of Mao Zedong, the communist revolutionary and founder of the People's Republic of China, the country was isolated. The area that's now called Shenzhen was just another collection of small, poor towns along the southern coast, close to the border with British-controlled Hong Kong, but cut off from the rest of the world.
But then Deng Xiaoping, the Chinese leader, in the early 1980s, they decide to sort of pursue this opening up policy.
Deng Xiaoping, who came to power 2 years after Mao's death, turned Mao's policy of isolation on its head, a process that began in Shenzhen. Here, Deng established Shenzhen as the country's first special economic zone, a designation that allowed the new city to skirt the nation's strict socialist policies and become a sort of experiment in market capitalism and foreign investment. It was a bold move, Zhang says, one that faced pushback from communist hardliners and skeptics who feared that a market-driven economy wouldn't be compatible with a communist state.
Actually, at the very beginning, no one expected the city can be so successful. And then, you know, step by step, the city become very successful.
Because of its proximity to Hong Kong, businesses quickly established new operations across the border. Tax incentives also encouraged foreign companies to set up manufacturing hubs. Demand for cheap labor then led to an influx of migrants from around the country, and Shenzhen saw an explosion in population and new money. In short, Deng Xiaoping's controversial experiment worked. Now, the city's story has reached an almost mythical status in China, embodied by the hit song Chuntian de Guxi, or Story of Spring. The song was written in the early 90s during the city's manufacturing boom and became a sort of national anthem celebrating Deng's policy of opening up. The song's popularity inspired even more people to move here after the city's initial boom. Today in Shenzhen, it's hard to walk around the city and not find some sort of monument celebrating what's now referred to as the Shenzhen Miracle. At the city's museum, which sits right next to a massive central government building, there's a permanent exhibit dedicated to the city's transformation. As you wind through, you're confronted with grandiose images of the city's impressive skyline and a barrage of patriotic videos playing on a loop, touting a mythical story of how the central government's policy of opening up Shenzhen to the world turned a tiny fishing village of just a few thousand people into a sprawling metropolis of millions. This entire exhibit, and the way Shenzhen is widely written about in Chinese and Western media, makes it seem like the city came out of nowhere and was all built at the snap of a government finger. But experts say that story is incomplete.
Oh, God, it is such a nice... Try that onion. It does such a good job with the onion.
That's Marianne O'Donnell, an ethnographer who I meet up with at a cozy restaurant in one of those dense, jumbled urban villages. Welch has lived in the area for decades and devotes her days to speaking with locals and documenting Shenzhen's transformation. She tells me the boomtown narrative is wrong.
They want to tell one story about Shenzhen. They want to tell one story.
But Welch says this is a city of many stories. Its initial population was roughly 10 times larger than what the government claims. And those people, along with the migrants who moved here, are the ones who built Shenzhen, not just the government. Welch agrees Shenzhen's growth is something of a miracle, but behind the glitzy buildings that light up and look impressive on postcards and museums and on Instagram, it's the dense, informal villages that allowed millions of migrants to come with no money and make a life for themselves in one of China's richest cities. These villages, Welch tells me, have disappeared in recent years in the name of progress. Planners replace them with malls and high-end residential buildings.
You know, they think it could be better. They think Shenzhen could be better. You know, more upscale.
after saying goodbye to Mary Ellen at the metro stop right on the edge of this urban village, I stop again to take in the sights and sounds. A small team of street vendors sit on plastic boxes with little tables to sell fruit and vegetables. One of them rings a bell to attract the attention of passersby. A police officer comes and makes the vendor move from the metro entrance, perhaps because small-time street vendors don't mesh with that upscale image the city is trying to maintain. The officer walks away, and seconds later, the street vendor is back. She unfolds her table, plops her fruit on it, starts ringing the bell once again, and the Miracle City's heart keeps beating. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel, Shenzhen, China.
Tomorrow, Jeremy continues reporting from Shenzhen, where he takes a ride in a pristine temperature-controlled subway system, encounters state surveillance and facial recognition technology, and hears about people working a grueling 72-hour work week. The pluses and minuses of life in the world's most thriving megacity, tomorrow on the show. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A black fungus found at the Chernobyl nuclear site is thriving, or at least...
What does is not die, basically, where anything else would really just die within a couple of minutes.
That's Niels Avresh. He's a researcher at the University of Florida. It was decades ago when Ukrainian scientists found the fungus growing where no life should. But now Avresh's team has discovered that the fungus also blocks radiation. That could turn out to have some practical uses for NASA, where Avresh also collaborates. But first, they need to confirm exactly how the fungus does all this.
The key chemical compound that helps it to survive these conditions is melanin. So it is possible that the melanin acts as a biological semiconductor, which alters its energy state when exposed to ionizing radiation. So we're basically trying to figure out if there can be a net energy gain for these fungi through the excitation of melanin in their cell wall.
So I guess kind of the analogy is plants use sunlight to grow, the fungus uses radiation?
Yeah, it's important to stress that it won't be the same as photosynthesis, but yeah, ultimately that is the idea. One form of a radiation would be sunlight, which plants use to fix carbon dioxide. The other one could be ionizing radiation, which these fungi might be able to use and basically grow better.
So when we say that this fungus grows, is it spreading like a kind of moss or any kind of fungus that you might see inside an old wet garage?
Yeah, exactly like that. So it needs still an energy source and a carbon source that it can use to mobilize into its biomass. But yeah, it'll grow similarly to any mold that you would observe in cold and wet areas like your garage, like you said, for example. Mm.
Your research found that the fungus doesn't just grow, it actually blocks radiation from the areas that it seems to cover. Tell us a bit more about that. How robust of a nuclear protectant is this fungus?
So, yeah, we found that it possibly blocks radiation. So a very thin layer of that fungus, about 2 millimeters, we found that it possibly blocks 2% of the radiation by using a simple Geiger counter. And if you extrapolate that to how much mass would be needed to block a significant part of galactic cosmic radiation, that is actually the same as common shielding materials that are high in protons, high in hydrogen, like water or polymeric plastics. So it is not necessarily a better shielding material than existing materials, but it is a self-regenerating one. So something that you can make and regenerate while on orbit rather than having to send up new materials every time you want to replace a radiation shield.
So I'm just curious, I mean, this is a form of black mold, correct? Isn't black mold toxic?
Toxic? I wouldn't necessarily eat it. Like, you wouldn't eat your moldy bread either, but you can touch it with your hands and throw it away or put it in the wall of your habitat in space.
Do you see a future need to actually propagate this fungus? Would there be labs or spaces where you would grow it?
Yes, and people are doing that already right now. There's my lab that's working on this species, trying to figure out how this fungus actually works and what radiation it is actually useful to protect against.
Nils, how exciting a discovery is this for you?
So at the time, it was a really exciting discovery. Yeah, it's a difficult field and something that I'm not entirely convinced that it has an immediate application. But if it does turn out that melanized fungi actually can use the energy from radiation, even if it's just to a very small degree, that would be a really exciting discovery because it could ultimately mean energy independence on space travel.
And when we say energy, I mean, what exactly are we talking about in terms of the energy on any trip in space?
So you'll always have to bring energy, whether it is charged batteries or solar panels or rocket fuel, you need an energy carrier, chemically or electrically. And the further away from Earth you go, the less there is. Unless you bring a nuclear reactor, you really only have sunlight, which gets dimmer and dimmer the farther away you go. But the background ionizing radiation stays the same. If anything, it gets stronger the further away from the sun you go. That is a constant energy flux. So if it would be possible to harness that, you'd be able to achieve a degree of energy independence that is otherwise impossible to achieve with a relatively small infrastructure.
Nils Afresh is a scientist working with NASA, telling us about the practical uses for a fungus that grows where nothing should. Afresh also teaches microbiology and biochemical engineering at the University of Florida. We leave you today with some sports news from this past weekend. Yesterday, the American institution that is Sunday Night Football got a bit more global.
The kick, it's up, it's out, and it's good! Charlie Smith!
Irishman Charlie Smith made his NFL debut last night for the New Orleans Saints. Smith never kicked a football until about 2 years ago. He previously played Gaelic football, a sport that's closer to rugby. But last night in the fourth quarter, Smith stepped onto the field like a pro. He nailed a 56-yard field goal and then pulled off a successful onside kick.
It must travel 10. Oh my God! The Saints win!
It wasn't enough to win the game. The Miami Dolphins ended up with the W, but Smith's strong showing was still cause for celebration back home. Locals went wild at a pub in Smith's hometown of Mayobridge, a small village in Northern Ireland. Everyone got a free pint when he scored the field goal, because, of course. Smith's family, mom, dad, and two sisters traveled all the way to the States to see him play in person. After the game, the 24-year-old told reporters his family was determined to be in the stands.
I think they traveled 23 hours, because they're through to Chicago and the flight got delayed because of snow. And then they flew down into Miami, so it was awesome to see them there.
Only a handful of Irish players have made a name for themselves in the NFL. Smith's journey to the league started in 2024. He tried out for the NFL's International Player Pathway Program on a bit of a whim, but his kicking foot impressed scouts. Smith joined the Saints less than a year later. After his performance last night, he's likely to get a few more minutes on the field, which could also mean more free pints in his hometown pub. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org and find more of our original reporting on YouTube. And while you're there, subscribe to our channel. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. We'll see you again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.